From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center, and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And here are the issues. President Obama reversed his earlier decision to withdraw all American troops from Afghanistan by the end of his term in 2017. Instead, and at the request of Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, the president said he would keep 9,800 soldiers in Iraq until late next year before reducing the contingent to 5,500. In Iran, it was learned that Washington Post correspondent Jason Razian was convicted of espionage in a secret trial, and Iran test-fired a precision-guided ballistic missile in apparent violation of United Nations Resolution 1929. In Israel, a rash of stabbings by Palestinians that killed 8 and wounded 80 was met by a strong crackdown by Israeli troops who sealed off East Jerusalem. And in Las Vegas, the first nationally televised debate among five Democratic presidential candidates produced a standout performance by Hillary Clinton. Well, let's start with this decision by President Obama, Barbara, which was not entirely unexpected. Why did he do this?
I don't think he had a choice. The Taliban is doing very well in Afghanistan. It's basically regained much of the territory that it lost after Obama first came in. You'll remember he had a surge in Afghanistan after he first came into office, and then he tried to start pulling troops back. He declared the end of the combat mission just not very long ago. But, you know, the enemy gets a vote, as we say. And according to Bill Roggio, who does something called the Long War Journal, at least half of the country is either controlled by the Taliban or heavily influenced by the Taliban, which is the most extensive Taliban footprint, I guess, since 2001. So what choice did he have?
Well, what choice did he have, David?
I agree with Barbara. I mean, essentially, we had, if you remember, this big rollout of a strategy by President Obama more than a year ago, which was that America was going to step back and it was going to enable allies on the ground. That the new smart thing to do was for America to be an enabling kind of catalyst power, and that allies on the ground were going to do the fighting. The problem is that's looking less like a strategy and more like a wish. And it just turns out it hasn't happened. We can see the same thing in Syria and Iraq, that the only thing that can really defeat ISIS on the ground is capable Sunni troops, but there just aren't Sunni troops available. So America is finding itself not in control of the strategy. And I think that, you know, there's no doubt that he could not have looked more reluctant as he announced these troops will be there. Let's not forget, this means there will be 5,500 American troops in Afghanistan after he leaves office.
And perhaps more.
He didn't intend for that to happen.
Go ahead, Barbara.
In fact, during the press briefing that followed this, the White House press secretary, Josh Earnest, was pressed on this, and he conceded that it was possible that there would still be 9,800 troops there when the president leaves office. He said that there would be 9,800 through next year, and then in 2017, the drawdown to 5,500 will begin. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, President Obama won't be President Obama in January of 2017, so, I mean, how can the drawdown begin? I think these troops are there for quite a while. One of the reasons, though, we have to remember why Obama wanted so much to get American troops out of Afghanistan was that the president for a long time was Hamid Karzai, who was a very difficult ally, to say the least. And now, I mean, this is sort of more like Iraq. We have a government in place in Kabul that is very friendly to the United States. Ashraf Ghani is certainly favored by the U.S., and he has a co-president, Abdullah Abdullah. We're also pretty high on him. And this is their urgent request, same as in Iraq, where, you know, we're there at the request of the government, of Haider al-Abadi.
But, of course, this government in Afghanistan, although, as you say, absolutely is far friendlier and has understood that the politics of coming to Washington and saying thank you is unbelievably important, because I think the American public and Congress feel very much that they've spent all this blood and treasure and have had no thanks from the Karzai government before. But it's not a fantastically effective government. They don't even have a defense minister at the moment in the middle of this war. So it's incredibly fragile. And the problem is, of course, that Barack Obama came into office making a distinction between Iraq, which he called a dumb war of choice, mm-hmm. and Afghanistan was his good war. And that was yep. in some ways mm-hmm. politically for him to show that he wasn't a pacifist, mm-hmm. that if right. he saw an interest in fighting mm-hmm. a war, he would fight that war. But let's not forget, his first defense secretary, Robert Gates, wrote these rather scorching memoirs last year in which he said that he always had the impression that Obama didn't really believe his own plan. Didn't really have any faith in his own plan in Afghanistan. There was always an element of politics involved.
Well, you say things in a campaign that you wind up having to do, and even when you don't want to do them. That certainly happens. My question is, Barbara, I think the American military initially talked about keeping 20,000 troops there, which seems like, militarily to me anyway, a more appropriate number, but that was never politically realistic.
Yeah, I think that figure is a bit high. Remember that we have 3,500 troops in Iraq now, mm-hmm. and there's a possibility, you know, we're flying sorties over Syria, there's a possibility of American special forces in Syria. Secretary of State John Kerry hinted at that in an NPR interview, which is interesting. And I'm told that there's still talk about, believe it or not, a no-fly zone in Syria going mm-hmm. on among the worker bee level in the Pentagon. And
gee, wouldn't that be hard with all these Russian planes there and these
it
drones,
would.
One of which was shot down by Turkey a few days ago?
It would be hard, mm-hmm. but it also would be a real statement to the Russians that mm-hmm. The United States gets to play in this arena as well.
Well, I'm not expecting that. You know, there's the question here that's been raised, one among others, by Peter Baker of the New York Times, and that is about the Iraq precedent, basically, where all the troops were removed. And we saw what some would argue a direct result of that is what ISIS now, and others would not agree with that. What about the Iraq precedent? Do you think that had some influence on the president? The New York Times, I think Peter Baker says, yes, it did.
Probably, although, of course, it's an inexact parallel, because the White House would say that they didn't necessarily choose to leave Iraq, that the Iraqi yeah. government and parliament at the time were not prepared to give them the legal assurances they needed to keep American
I
troops
know,
there.
But don't you think
others say that that was politically convenient, that it didn't yeah, break Obama's
sure.
heart
yeah.
to remove his troops
right.
from
mm-hmm.
Iraq.
Okay.
You know, America is pulling back, consciously and announcing it's pulling back, and that has consequences.
David, I'll return to you in a minute after this short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Barbara Slavin and David Rennie, who I so rudely interrupted when you were talking about what happened in Iraq earlier when all the troops were pulled out, and we know that Iraq is in terrible shape. Now, what influence that might have had on President Obama in deciding what to do in Afghanistan?
I think that clearly he accepts in some circumstances a vacuum can be created, which makes things mm-hmm. worse. I think what's remarkable is how he is not accepting this in the case of Syria. There are a lot of voices saying that the rise of ISIS is not just in Iraq, but also in Syria, that mm-hmm. the arrival of Russia is a direct consequence of a perception that President Obama is pulling back and creating a vacuum and that America is weak. I traveled last week with the American Defense Secretary for several days in Europe. This came up a lot. He pushes back loyally. He says that absolutely not, that there is no vacuum created by America, that essentially there isn't a good plan for American action in Syria that is going to make things better, that Russia's presence in Syria is irrational and illogical and can lead to no good for Russia. And therefore, essentially, their argument is Russia has kind of jumped into a quagmire. America has no business jumping into the quagmire next to Russia just for the sake of doing something. So whether you agree with that or disagree with that, I think what's clear is that President Obama's move in Afghanistan does not signal that across the board, all around the world, he's going to start intervening as his critics would like him to. I think Afghanistan is a case on its own, and he remains incredibly stubborn and opposed to doing more in Syria.
Yeah, I certainly agree with that, Barbara.
Again, I'm not entirely sure. I think that the situation in Syria is very dynamic, shall we say. And we do see that the United States has stepped up arms deliveries, airdrops of arms to the Kurds and some affiliated Arab fighters in northern Syria. This seems to be in direct response to what the Russians are doing. I participated in a war game recently at the Atlantic Council, and there were administration officials who participated in this as well as former senior officials, and the consensus was that the United States needs to double down on both diplomacy and military action. that there was still talk of a no-fly zone, but certainly of sending in more special forces, of trying to direct the airstrikes a little bit better, and of not letting the Russians intimidate us or the Turks.
I have to say that traveling with the defense secretary, no-fly zones are just not on the table at that level. They see that it's a very substantial military task, now made, as you say, Fred, much more complicated by having the Russians there. Even more modest things, you've seen people calling for no-bombing zones, where you would say to the Syrians, if you take helicopters from that airfield and drop barrel bombs on civilians, you will lose that airfield to a cruise missile, or you'll lose those helicopters. Mm-hmm. You put that to senior people in the Pentagon, and they say, well, what's the legal basis? Mm-hmm. We can't just go bombing airfields unless we've declared war on Assad. And for the moment, overt military-to-military action against the Syrian government is not this government's policy. Now, that hides a lot of covert stuff that the CIA is doing. And that, I think, you're right, Barbara, absolutely. There's big airdrops of munitions, and the CIA is very active, but not the military.
Well, let's turn to Iran, Barbara, and the conviction of this Washington Post correspondent who you know. And the question is, obviously, President Obama has been trying to improve relations tremendously with the Iranians. Obviously, the Iran nuclear deal is a part of that. But why are the Iranians doing this in the case of this correspondent?
Well, it has more to do with domestic politics in Iran, frankly, than it does with the relationship with the United States. Jason Rezaian is a sweet, harmless, was extremely optimistic young man. He's from Northern California. He went to Iran. He wanted to build bridges between the two countries. The last person on earth you could imagine doing anything that would break anybody's law, frankly. And he's just an unfortunate pawn in this situation. There are elements in Iran that are very nervous about the nuclear deal because they see this as fundamentally transforming the relationship between Iran and the West, and Iran and the United States in particular. So they're holding on to poor Jason as a way of showing the president of Iran, Hassan Rouhani, that the nuclear deal is a one-off. You get this. We understand we need sanctions relief. We can't go on like this anymore. But you're not going to liberalize our society. You're not going to open up to the United States. We're not going to become best buddies with the great Satan. So he's just a pawn in this, and it's very, very sad.
David, what about the Ayatollah? He can certainly tell the Revolutionary Guard or whoever is trying this Washington Post reporter, he can tell him what to do.
I mean, certainly people in Washington said in the run-up to the Iran nuclear deal being kind of signed and sealed, that the big existential question was, does the Ayatollah think of Iran as an ordinary country with some serious disputes with the United States, or a country whose entire identity is based on opposition to the United States, a kind of an essentially a revolutionary project as opposed to a hostile state?
Well, right now it seems like number two.
It seems like the rhetoric, I mean, the Ayatollah is always careful never to come down entirely on one side. Part of his game is to keep people guessing. The mystique is there. But certainly, you know, you have seen this sort of double rhetoric of praising the negotiators while saying incredibly stern and hostile things about the kind of broader context.
Yeah. So, David, it's much more cynical than that. Who knows what he actually believes? I don't think anybody thinks that Iran is still a revolutionary state. This is pure politics. There are factions within the governing elite that are very powerful, that are very nervous about this nuclear deal, if not in outright opposition to it. So he's throwing them a bone, that's all. Poor Jason is a bone. This is not about exporting the Iranian revolution. This is about the naked exercise of power and maintaining spheres of influence as a way of deterring your enemies.
I guess if you're American President Obama, actually one of the bigger questions right now is this Iran capable of being in any sense helpful in Syria when the moment comes that they might be helpful? When the Russians and the Americans and the Iranians and everyone else finds themselves around the table, if we ever get to a political process to find a way out of the civil war?
No, right now it looks like no. All right, time for another break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes with David Rennie and Barbara Slavin. You wanted to add something.
Yeah, in terms of David's comment about Syria and if we ever get to negotiations, look, I think the Iranians want to have as many cards as possible to play if and when that day comes. So that's how I interpret a lot of their activities. I should say, though, that the Iranians are bleeding from Syria. They've lost three Revolutionary Guards generals. in just the space of about 10 days. And there are reports they've sent, you know, maybe 1,000 troops to Syria, which would be something new because in the past they've relied on Arab Shia and Afghan Shia, Pakistani Shia militias that they've created, and they've not sent their own ground forces. So, you know, this could be a sign that they are very, very worried that Assad is not going to be able to make it.
David, let's turn to Israel and this rash of stabbings and a tough response by the Israelis. And are we headed into a third intifada?
People are saying at the moment that it doesn't feel quite the same as the last intifada. But, you know, this is, you know, we've got used to fewer sort of suicide bombings and things because you have the separation wall between the Palestinians and the Israelis in so many contexts. But Jerusalem is special. You have East Jerusalem full of Arab and Palestinians living with no wall between them and Israelis. And this is the result of the 6-7 war. And they share the Temple Mount. You have clearly Jews who regard it as their most holy place. You have Muslims who regard it as their most holy place. And you have tremendous tensions around the sharing of the city and tremendous growing tensions around the sharing of the Temple Mount. And in particular, as far as we can tell, seething belief on the Palestinian side that Israel's government, despite denials from the Israeli government, is considering changing the status of the Temple Mount and allowing Jews more rights to go and pray on this holy place. And that seems to be sparking these terrible kind of homemade stabbing attacks and really destroying what little trust remained that Palestinians and Israelis can live side by side.
Yeah, these attacks do seem more spontaneous, but there is this cleric in Gaza who has urged stabbings in particular, Barbara.
It's a tragic situation, but there are also a lot of ironies in it. You know, Israel annexed East Jerusalem. They have declared that this city will never be divided, and now what are they doing? They're dividing it again for their own protection. There are Jewish settlers in East Jerusalem, in areas right outside. Israel has increasingly taken over territory in these areas, and that makes those people vulnerable because they have put themselves into, you know, areas that are predominantly Arab. The other aspect, of course, is that a lot of the violence has taken place even on the other side of the Green Line within pre-67 Israel. There have been cases of Israeli Arabs who are citizens attacking Israeli Jews, and even in one case, an Israeli Jew who attacked another Israeli Jew because he thought he was an Arab. You know, so I think it's very tense. Prime Minister Netanyahu has put forward no plan, no vision for a two-state solution that would give Palestinians any hope of having their own state. There's a lot of discrimination against Israeli Arabs. Mm-hmm. You may remember that during his last election campaign, he warned Israeli Jews that they'd better come out and vote because the Arabs were coming in droves to vote. I mean, what a racist appeal.
Okay, so Barbara, but to be...
you know, they've got to work on a peace settlement. They also have to work on their own internal dynamics, which are affected by the lack of a peace settlement.
There's blame on both sides.
Oh, of course,
you know,
of course.
The Economist has been very critical in the past of Israeli settlement building and stuff, but the Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas has not covered himself in glory this week.
No,
he's been
hasn't.
Giving press conferences talking about the Israelis carrying out the summary execution of a child who then turned out to be alive and in an Israeli hospital. So essentially, I think what's so tragic about this week is that exactly these events that are happening now, these stabbings among sort of civilians, these stabbings by Israeli Arabs of Jewish Israelis and vice versa, if you are the most paranoid and hostile and nativist voices on both sides, mm-hmm. what is happening this week gives you every comfort. If you are a paranoid, extreme hardliner on both sides saying, we can never live with these people, they cannot be trusted, the events of this week are proving those worst and most sort of bleak voices.
Right. Well, if you can't live with each other, you should separate. And, you know, where is the peace plan, right?
Well, didn't the Israelis, just to make an historical point, didn't the Israelis offer to divide Jerusalem?
No.
And, no, the agreement back in 2000, when sponsored by President Clinton in particular?
That's somewhat disputed, but...
Certainly President Clinton doesn't dispute it.
The fact is that those talks failed and we had, Intifada number two.
Well, they failed.
We can blame Yasser Arafat, long dead, for the fact that those talks failed. And I'm perfectly happy to put a lot of blame at the feet of Yasser Arafat. The fact remains that Bibi Netanyahu has never offered to divide Jerusalem.
That may be true, but the Israelis did back then. And it was turned, you say it failed. It failed because it was turned down by the Palestinians.
Yeah. Well, that doesn't mean it would be turned down a second time.
Well, then, no, it doesn't. But we'll see. David, you visited Las Vegas for the first time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Viva Las Vegas.
That's always an eye-opener.
I did not gamble. I did not get married. But I did watch Hillary Clinton on the debate stage. And that in itself was, you know, there were no white tiger cubs. Mm-hmm. There were no kind of girls in dancing vests. Mm-hmm. But she put on a pretty good show.
She did.
Essentially, this was, let's not forget, we've had a couple of Republican debates which were, you know, the Donald Trump extravaganza. So people thought, this first Democratic debate is a very big deal for Hillary Clinton. Her poll numbers were not as good as they mm-hmm. should be. Donors were starting to get jumpy. Democrats like to get jumpy. It's what they do. They're jumpy people. And so they were getting nervous. And the other thing that was very odd about this debate is that traditionally, a presidential debate is the chance for the country and for pundits like us to look at the stage and say, which of these many people is a viable candidate mm-hmm. who could take the White House? In this case, there's only one viable person on stage who could take the White House. It's Hillary Clinton. So this was not, in fact, a debate. This was an audition for Hillary Clinton. Mm-hmm. It was Hillary versus Hillary. Mm-hmm. That was what it fundamentally yeah. was, whether Hillary's good side was going to win out over her bad side. And she was on very good form. Mm-hmm. Now, there will be some people who will say, no, Bernie Sanders, her left-wing challenger, also did really, really well.
I personally thought
he didn't do well.
Yeah.
But he introduced himself to some people out there who'd never heard his kind of populist message, who will like his populist message. But I think what was interesting was that when he got off his signature themes about economic questions, when he got onto things like foreign policy, he was really terrible. Mm-hmm. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He doesn't like being criticized. He's very thin-skinned. He did not look presidential.
No, I agree with that. And he also said, America should style itself on Denmark and Sweden. I don't think that's a... Anyway, Barbara, what did you make of the debate?
I'm a little kinder toward Bernie Sanders, I guess. But no, I thought, the thing that most impressed me, that here were five adults on stage who were all credible individuals. Maybe Hillary looked the most presidential to you, David. But, you know, they all had experience. They had been senators, governors, mayors. They were none of them amateurs or a carnival barker. There wasn't a neurosurgeon with a very slim grasp of history. There wasn't a failed CEO like Carly Fiorina and then some other people. There were actually people who had political experience and had reasonable ideas.
You were impressed with, say, Lincoln Chafee, the former governor of Rhode Island?
His comment that he was like a block of granite left me a little confused.
I think what
but still, he said some sensible things about Iraq, about foreign mm-hmm. policy. It was a very substantive debate. Mm-hmm. There was no trivia discussed. It was all serious stuff.
It's also a very disciplined party. I think that's what's so striking is in previous election cycles, we've been used to the fact that Democrats kind of are self-indulgent and they run after this and that candidate mm-hmm. who excites them. Whereas Republicans, after a bit of noise and a bit of shouting, mm-hmm. traditionally the idea was that Republicans would, they would date all kinds of exciting people and then they would marry the person who pleased the establishment, the person who pleased the donors,
well,
and the Republicans
do.
Were focused on
yeah.
winning.
They're not there yet,
no,
but they usually do.
They're not there
do.
Yet, but the Democrats really are. I mean, one of the things that's very striking is mm-hmm. if you go to a rally with thousands of supporters of Bernie Sanders, the main challenger to Hillary Clinton, ask them, would you like Bernie Sanders to try and take down Hillary Clinton and destroy her? And they're like, no. Because ultimately, mm-hmm. though they're not that keen on Hillary Clinton, they really, really want to win the next election. They're mm-hmm. incredibly focused on beating the Republicans in the next election. Mm-hmm. So for once, it's the Democrats who are a very disciplined party at the moment.
Where does this lead? One of the sort of most remembered event at this debate was when Bernie Sanders said, let's forget about all these emails,
Barbara,
that have been such a problem for Hillary Clinton. And it got a huge cheer from the Democratic crowd mm-hmm. and also people in the press room, or so it was reported. What happens to Hillary after this? You still have the FBI investigation. She has to testify before this committee.
Yeah. I think Bernie Sanders is helping to put that whole story to rest. It was a very gallant comment on his part.
Yeah, but how does that change any of these facts?
Because there is no there. I mean, there will be more emails released, but what have we learned? We've learned that old friends of Hillary sent her emails trying to give her this or that, that there was information that was subsequently considered classified that was contained, but that, none of these emails were marked classified.
Exactly. I mean, that's true at the moment, and it's certainly true that Republicans are taking a political advantage of talking this up. But it remains the case that America has these incredibly strict laws about how you handle classified
information. Yeah, but they're not ex post facto.
We don't know. All I can tell you is that when I talk to pretty senior Democrats, is she completely home clear? Or do you still worry that something might come up and suddenly she's getting indicted? They're not privately completely certain that she's home clear. But there's a lot of deep, deep anxiety that something could be there that they just don't know about. And then they don't have an alternative. That's the flip side of a disciplined party, is they don't have an alternative.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Barbara Slavin, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council South Asia Center and Washington correspondent for AlMonitor.com, and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. This program was produced by Carol Castile. Our engineer was Bill Barber. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.